This is Build and Analyze, the weekly news and discussion show about the world of iPhone, iPad, iOS, and mobile web development. The show is hosted by Marco Arment. He's the creator, founder of Instapaper and the magazine. By me, I'm Dan Benjamin. It's Monday, December 17th, 2012. Momentous day. This is our 108th episode. It is also our final episode. That's right. This is the last episode of Build and Analyze ever. We would like to say thank you very much for sponsorship by Hover.com, SourceBits.com, and Shutterstock.com. We'll tell you more about them as the show continues. We also want to say thank you very much to our bandwidth sponsor who's been with us through the whole month of December. It's Igloo, your digital workplace. That means you can give updates, have discussions, and share files with your team all in one place. Sign up and get started at igloosoftware.com/5x5.
Maybe I wonder if today we can use the actual fish song that our theme song is loosely based upon, which is actually a Sun Seals song that Fish covered, but I think Fish does a way better version of it, and I think Sun Seals agrees.
Isn't Fish a fairly litigious organization?
No, I did, for the record.
Because that could end me, Marco. That could end me.
We did inquire with them to see if we could license one of their recordings of Funky Bitch, and obviously there's the complexity that it's actually a Sun Seals song that Fish plays covers of in their concerts. Ah. So that's one complexity.
Okay.
But from what I gather, Fish just doesn't really care about licensing their stuff. Like, they just don't want to be dealing with that. So generally they don't license their stuff, not because they don't want anybody to use it, but because they just don't, like, they, like, their organization just doesn't really give that much of a crap about getting that all figured out and dealing with that. So anyway, that's why we can't use the real song. But one of our listeners wrote a song that's inspired loosely on that style, and it's such a generic style apparently that that's okay. I don't know how that worked exactly. So on today's final episode, I figured we would take a special look back at cherished moments from the past episodes.
Really?
No.
<That's>, I haven't.
That's always such a cop out when shows do that.
That would be great. I mean, at least it'd be something.
No, we can't do that. That's like the whole the Seinfeld final episode was such a train wreck.
So bad. So bad.
So, I mean, that was awful. It was like such a horrible ending to what was such a great series.
Yeah. It really was not a good episode.
Really, the series really does not age well because of the laugh track and live audience. Like that.
Oh man, you're so right about that. I feel the same way.
Every sitcom from that era that has like a live audience or a simulated live audience, and so, you know, you have to pause and let everybody laugh or clap after everything. That did not age well at all. And so, like, you look back and see those shows now,
right?
And it's rough. It's kind of hard to watch, actually. They're hard to sit through.
Yeah, and that's the weird thing, is that during that time period, you had this phenomenon of the laugh track, which is just so weird now when you think about it. It strikes me as being so odd that we had this laugh track, like a superimposed people laughing. I don't
know.
It's
like weird. Training wheels on how to watch the show. Yeah. It's like, oh, that was funny. I'm supposed to laugh now.
Right. In case you were by yourself, this is when to laugh. We will help you.
Right. It's kind of bizarre. You know, it's weird.
And I would like to see a side-by-side comparison of an episode of Seinfeld without the laugh track versus with the laugh track, and see if I would still know when to laugh, if I would still know what was funny.
I think people have done that on YouTube. I'm pretty sure. I think I saw one a few years ago. I think somebody did exactly that, where they either cut out the parts where people were laughing, so, you know, just making it shorter, or they muted the laughter. And it really is like it's a very different show, you know.
Do they? I don't watch any sitcoms anymore at all. Do they still have laugh tracks on stuff?
I think some do. I'm not sure, honestly. I bet the new ones probably don't, but I don't know. I'm so far removed from like mainstream TV at this point, which I know is like a really snobby kind of Portland thing to say, but we primarily watch like the fancy HBO and Showtime shows, and we watch them all through Netflix and iTunes and everything else. Like, we haven't had cable service for like 6 years now, and we don't miss it at all.
They trust you to know when to laugh on those shows.
Right. Also, you know, like one of the things that also I think helps ruin a show for me is aggressive use of background music.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like that also, like it just kind of cheapens the show for me.
It's like it's walking you through the emotional landscape of the show, as if you can't figure out that, you know, when the guy's been shot and the lady is crying, that it might be the sad part.
Right. Or like the suspenseful music, because right, something's about to happen. You better get on the edge of your seat.
Yeah.
Prepare to be shocked, you know, or you know, get a little nervous for this character, because we can't show that enough, or they're not a good enough actor to show it themselves. So
Pavel Vaskovic on Twitter says The Big Bang Theory also has live audience laughing.
I never saw that.
I've heard
mixed things about it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, it's weird having this be like our final episode and knowing about it as we were recording it, because I feel like most podcasts just kind of get abandoned. Like they, most podcasts don't have like an official final episode. They just kind of stop working. You know, oh, we just decided to stop going to work today. So it's weird. Like, and even most of your shows, like I know the conversation ended with a show that knew it was its last show.
Right.
But I feel like most of your other shows that have ended, have they had like farewell shows? Is this a common thing or not really?
I would say maybe 50-50, maybe. Most, I would say, probably just sort of go, you know, we wind up not doing them or stop doing them. But see, the commercialization of them, if you will, if I can.
I guess that changes things. Yeah.
It does change things, because when a sponsor signs up and they're expecting to sponsor a certain show, and then if the show's not going to be there, you know, they need to know, and you need to explain to them why it might not be there and what's going on. And, you know, like the new shows that have started up, the crossover is a good example. You know, I've started it up and I've been doing it kind of biweekly. As this show and Hypercritical come to an end, the replacement shows crossover, and then the other one will switch over to weekly and fill the essentially the same time slots. Because I can only do the way my workflow is, I can only do a certain number of shows. It's hard, very hard to do the extra shows. So like that is also in mind, and sponsors know about it. And anyway, there's a lot of moving parts. But if it's the podcast in the sense of like, you know, two guys in a room or remotely recording, and then they're like, something happens, they get busy, their families get busy, it's a holiday, so they just, well, we're not going to do it. And they just, I don't know if I want to do it. My boss needs me to work extra next week, so let's not do it. And then eventually there's no more shows.
Right. Like it's really hard once you no longer have a regular schedule. Like I know our friends Daniel Jocko and Manton Reese at Core Intuition.
Core Intuition.
They went a long, I think they went like a year without an episode or something like that.
Yeah.
And like they were doing this podcast on a, as far as I know, it was always like a non-fixed schedule, just like whenever they would feel like doing it, and they would try to do it every so often, but there was not like a fixed schedule for it. And so over time, you know, as both of them were busy with their jobs and their lives and their families and everything, it just slowed down to be less and less frequent until there was a span of like 6 months or a year where there was not a single new episode. And then what they started doing, they brought it back a few months ago, I think, maybe even 6 months ago by now. They brought it back where they started taking sponsors and started dedicating a time slot of, you know, we're going to do it at this time every single week. And they have stuck with that ever since then, because it had this regular time slot and these sponsors that were booking things. And even though like at the beginning, it probably wasn't that much money, but it was the idea of committing to doing this one thing every single week. And the sponsor kind of helps them keep committed.
I had suggested, I've known Manton for, gosh, I mean, probably 8 years.
Such a nice guy. So tall.
He's too tall, first of all. And second of all, he still owes me a... Yeah. And second of all, he still owes me a firewire cable. And he knows exactly what I'm talking about. No, he knows exactly what I'm talking about. And it's, you know, he knows what he needs to do. Let me put it that way. He knows how to make things right. And I had gone to him and I had said, listen, you guys, you have a good show. You should do something to help, you know, make it, this is before they got the sponsor. And I said, you should do something to make this a regular thing. And I said, I know that you guys could make money. I'm not saying you know, you're going to be able to quit your jobs and stop making software and do it full time, but this could be a nice additional income, even if it's a few $100 here and there. But you've got to get on a regular schedule. You've got to get on a regular schedule. Like the secret to having a successful podcast, obviously it's got to be a good show, but it doesn't matter how good it is. If it's not regular, people will feel like they can't rely on the show happening.
Exactly.
And so now that whatever it took to finally, you know, push them over to the dark side of making money, it's been beneficial for the show and beneficial for the listeners. So
Exactly. Because you know, anything that makes the show more regular, you know, before it was all like the show was almost dead. You know, it might as well have been dead when they were releasing it like every 6 months, you know. But now it's great. And that's, by the way, that's a show of Core Intuition that you should be listening to if you listen to this show for the development topics.
Right.
Because they actually talk about development topics all the time. With us, you know, it's always been kind of hit or miss. So if you're looking for a replacement of this time slot, that's a show that actually does talk about development topics. So, anyway,
and I told them, I said, listen, if you guys ever just want us, you know, we would help. We could edit it. We could, you know, produce it and whatever you want. And they said, no, we're just going to go on, keep on our own. So I offered them that years ago, back when I still lived in Oviedo.
I don't even, is that Florida? Is that like what the natives call it?
Yeah, that's the native word for Florida in the native tongue.
So I think maybe Dr. Drang was right about his tweet about the comic books. You see this?
Oh,
Dr. Drang
yes.
said, I'm beginning to think Dan Benjamin eased Syracuse and Mark Ormond out because they wouldn't do comic books.
That's right.
That's you got it. That's it. Drang.
And you saw my reply to that, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's that you that's it. That you know, we were trying to keep it secret.
Right.
But in reality, you know, the truth of the matter, I can tell you this in our last episode. The truth is that Dan is building an all comic book network.
That's
all
right.
Comic books all the time. and any show that was not willing to discuss comic books all the time will be ending in the next few weeks.
Yeah.
So yeah. You know, and 2013 is gonna be a great year for comics. And I wish you all the best in your endeavors in your comic book network.
And, you know, I almost thought I had Syracuse too. I almost had him because he's the type that, you know, he could go that way.
Right. I mean, you knew I was a lost cause.
No, I don't know.
I don't know a thing about comic books. The only comic book I've ever read was the Sonic the Hedgehog comic from the 90s when Sonic the Hedgehog was popular. I subscribed and every month that came in the mail, I would read the Sonic comic. Mm-hmm. And it was... As comics go, I have no idea how good it was. You know, uh-huh. I haven't looked at it as an adult. I don't think I still have them anymore anywhere. But it probably wasn't very good. I mean, that's, you know, that's the kind of thing that wouldn't be very good, you know.
Yeah.
So that is my that's my only experience with comics. But yeah, I think Merlin's doing well with comics though. You know, he's made the transition very well. You know, he has had like four last episodes, but But I think overall you guys have made the transition in that show very smoothly, and I think some people in the audience still believe this whole ruse that that it's about productivity.
Yeah, well that's
and not
you know,
about comics.
It's all about the bait and switch with him. You know,
well, you have to ease the people in slowly.
Yeah, I mean you want to get
it's like
people...
it's like boiling a lobster or boiling a frog. I guess what's the thing?
Well, I don't know. Where if you put
or is that a myth?
I think it is a myth, but if you take a frog and you put it in, you know, water and then you slowly increase the temperature of the water, that it will eventually, it won't jump out, even though it could, because it doesn't notice that the water is increasing in temperature and then it will be cooked alive. I don't believe that is true.
Right. But
I
anyway,
have
yeah,
eaten frog legs.
That's how it's the slow immersion effect of your transformation of everybody into not only comic book shows, but transforming the audience into comic book listeners. Because I keep listening to all your comic book shows, having no clue what you're talking about, but I keep listening.
Yeah,
so it's working.
Merlin has really embraced the whole comic book thing in a way that I couldn't be happier about. Because, I mean, I love this stuff. I've always loved talking about it, and very clearly gone off the deep end with it, but his life is so much better, I think, because of it.
And well, he's made
mine
a whole
is,
thing of it, like he's doing it with his daughter and everything.
Yeah.
That's a whole family thing now. That's like part of his life. That's a big part of his life now.
And see, I think he's more public about it than I am. Like my kid's entire room is pretty much like Batman, Spider-Man themed. 90% of his toys are Batman, Spider-Man, and that's by his choice. I mean, we expose him to all the kids' stuff, you know, and this is what he gravitates toward, which is pretty cool.
I can't wait until I can have this with my kid. Where,
how old is he now?
About 8 months.
Eight months old. Yeah.
Between seven and eight.
Does he respond more to like trucks or anything in particular?
He responds to anything that's new. Yeah. And by immediately putting it in his mouth.
Yeah.
So
oh yeah. Yeah.
He's at that stage. So, but I'm looking forward to the time when I can expose him to like four things, all of which are awesome, that I like. And to have him choose one of those, and then I can tell myself, oh, he likes the same things I do. Even though that's, you know, that's all the choice I gave him.
Yeah.
That's probably one of the best things about being a parent is that you can reinforce all the things you like. I mean, isn't that the only reason why people like sports? Isn't that pretty much like because their parents like watch sports?
Yeah, I mean, I think if you grow up, if you like, I always remember growing up, and especially my granddad more than my dad always was watching, you know, football, baseball, and then golf whenever those two weren't on. And like, those are the sports that I like, you know, and, you know, I don't have no interest in the NBA. If that, I don't even know if they still make that. I don't watch hockey. I'm aware of it peripherally. Soccer is not really anything I ever have any interest in, but you know, so, and the teams that I like, the teams are determined based on, you know, where I was born and raised. But I understand that people whose parents like a certain team, even if they're living somewhere else, grew up liking it. Like my son knows, for example, you know, we're Eagles fans. So if the Eagles are playing somebody else, you know, then he knows to root for the Eagles and to not, you know, not root for the other guys. Like he's very clear on that. Same with the Phillies. And
that's the thing. Like I feel like I feel like I would be more into sports if I cared about any particular teams.
Yeah.
And you know, I'm from Columbus, Ohio, and Columbus does not have any pro teams of any sports that matter in this country. So, you know, they have a Triple-A baseball team, mm-hmm. the Columbus Clippers, which the rumor was always that they were like a farm team.
No, but you've got Ohio State.
I don't know what that's
You've got
about.
Ohio State.
Right. But that's not like the NFL.
Well,
and so Ohio
don't say
State
that around
is,
Ohio State fans.
I know. Believe me, I know. there's no room for an NFL team in Columbus.
Right.
Like people are so obsessed with OSU football and somewhat basketball, mostly football. They're so obsessed with OSU football that like an NFL team just wouldn't like they don't have enough willpower and fandom to share with an NFL team, which is probably why they don't have one, because. I think it's a way bigger city than Cleveland, but I don't know. Anyway, so I never really had like a team affiliation with any pro team, and like I never watched sports as a family activity growing up, because no parent or you know role model in my life liked sports that much that I would have been exposed to it that much. So I just never did. I mean, and you know, Owen. Rob Mathers in the chat room brought up the Columbus Blue Jackets, which I think is their hockey team. But they started that team. I think I was already in high school when they started that team. And then there's also a soccer team that's the Columbus Crew. I can't believe I remember this. Yeah, they started a soccer team too back when I think that was also during my high school time when they decided that soccer like in the US was going to be a bigger thing.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Somebody decided this. And so they started putting all these soccer teams in all these different cities, and I went to one game with my friends, and I like we didn't care. You can't make Americans care about soccer. I don't care what you do, you just can't do it. Like we're so invested in football, and even you know, I don't know what it is about. Like, does the soccer season conflict with one of our more profitable sports seasons or something?
I don't. Yeah, I mean, I just follow the NFL and I follow the MLB, and that's pretty much it. I don't even college for like I had season tickets to go see UCF, University of Central Florida, which is where I went, where I graduated from. Anyway,
why'd you have to see it if you went there?
Well, I mean, we'd go and
didn't you see it a lot when you were there?
When I was there, they did not have very much of a football team, unfortunately. However, they revitalized the program and they developed what was actually quite a good football team. And I had season tickets for a couple, 2-3 years and went to every single game, every single home game. And I had a great time going to that, even though I mean, you get into caring about the team. You wonder what's going to happen. You look forward, you know, you start researching the opponent, who's injured. But I never got to be the level that I have with the NFL. Never quite got to that level.
Pretty much the extent of my sports knowledge is that football makes all the money in the country and is probably the most ingrained in our culture. And then everyone else is pretty much on strike, except soccer, which nobody cares about. Is that generally the case?
I mean, that's what my understanding of it is. I mean, okay, so baseball is America's pastime, right? But the NFL is America's sport. And there are plenty of people. I don't know anybody these days. Like, if you like baseball, it seems likely that you also enjoy the NFL. I don't know a lot of people who are just into baseball, but I do know a lot of people who are just into the NFL. In fact, I would say most the people that I know that like sports at all, they're into the NFL.
Well, it's so intense.
It is fairly intense.
And it's also football, I think, possibly more than all the other major sports. I think football is the most TV friendly. Don't you think?
Well, I mean, it certainly...
I can't believe we're talking about this.
I know. I love the word, too. This is perfect for our final episode. I don't know if it's TV friendly or if the entire game has been bastardized so much to make it into the ultimate TV friendly thing. Because, you know, football is a series of small battles. So the perfect place for a commercial is in between these small battles where the team, or the Warriors, if you will, are regrouping and deciding how they're going to launch their next attack.
Only that, too. I mean, like, so, you know, the timing of the plays and everything and all these gaps, because there's so much downtime in football, that is very commercial friendly. But also, as a viewer who's you know, between all this ripping off of your eyeballs and stuff, I think it's easier to watch football. It's easier to see what's happening. You know, like hockey, they have to do crazy things with, like, making the puck have a stripe behind it and stuff so you can see it. Baseball... you know, it's kind of hard to see sometimes, kind of hard to see the ball and where it goes. It's so small and you know, like sometimes they can lose it for a second with the camera shots live.
Yeah.
You know, the field in baseball is very, very big and you can't really be zoomed in and focused on the whole thing. So you might be missing something that's happening somewhere else if you're focusing somewhere else. Whereas like football, I feel like, you know, if you just keep your eye on the ball, like everyone pretty much moves down the field in a block. You don't have to be watching the entire football field. You can just be watching roughly where the ball is,
Yeah. And
maybe some of the people who are running to catch it if it gets thrown. And that's pretty much all you need to be watching. So it's easier to keep track of what's going on.
Okay, so first of all,
you can't like lose track of it because the action's so quick. Like you just need to pay attention for like 12 seconds while they figure out this play, and then it's over. And then they're going to replay it 10 billion times before the next play.
Well, you're exaggerating, but I'll tell you what, there are three or four different television views. One of them we are not allowed to see, and that is the entire overhead view of the entire field. Okay, this is something that the coaches get to see, the players get to see. You know, later on when they're watching the replays, but we as general population do not get to see this view. I forget the name of this view, but it's an overhead view, and I'll tell you why. A real football fan wants to see this because you get to see not just a little tiny bit of the formation at the line. You get to see the whole thing. You get to see the wide receivers. You get to see who's doing what. You get to see everything, and you get to see how all of this is happening. And yeah, then I guess technically you could lose track of the ball maybe, but this view you don't usually get to see. You usually get to see the close-up view of the quarterback. You get to see the men on the line. And then sometimes you see like a sort of wider, farther back angled view of 2/3 of the field. But there's a lot that's happening that you don't get to see that once in a while you get to see, like on the NFL has the NFL. What is it called? NFL Films shows you this. And there. But apparently I've read an article not too long ago that's like the networks don't think people want and or don't want to release this to us. But anyway, I digress.
Oh man, it's weird. Like
NFL, I'd like to watch an NFL game with you.
I don't know. I typically only watch the Super Bowl, and even then, I don't watch it every year. Like if we go to a Super Bowl party, then I will occasionally pay attention to the game. But that's about the only time I ever watch any sport. It's very strange. You know, besides like, you know, well, like sometimes I'll be in a restaurant. If there's a TV screen within my field of view, I can't not watch it.
No, and that's every man.
I think that's everybody, which is why they put TVs in so many places. And of course, TV is designed, you know, all the shots and the timing and everything are designed to catch your attention if you're only loosely paying attention.
Yeah.
So, you know, I see sports sometimes that are, you know, if it's on a TV in a restaurant or a bar that I'm hanging out at, that I'm eating dinner in or something. But I try to usually avoid sitting in a place where I can see it so I'm not distracted, but sometimes you can't avoid it. But I don't know. It's weird when you leave a job. You know, like I feel like I'm leaving a job here, but this is, yeah, I've left a lot of jobs in the past.
Yeah.
And I guess not a ton. It's weird, like all those work friends that you had at the job. I always found this with all the jobs I've left in the past, all my work friends, I always think those relationships are stronger than they really are. And I've heard this from other people too, so I think I'm not alone in this. You know, you always, these people who you spend, you know, generally speaking, I think most people spend more time awake with their people at work mm-hmm. than they do with their families or their spouses.
Generally true.
And so these people are, you know, you're spending tons of time in your life with these people. And then the job ends and usually you never see any of them again. Like, is this, I think this is true for most people. I'm curious to hear from you in the chat room. You know, like how often when you leave a job, you know, you always think, oh yeah, we'll hang out, you know, and then it never happens. Have you found that to be the case too?
Yeah. No,
like,
totally.
Every time.
Yeah. Every time.
That's weird.
Yeah.
How do adults make friends? I don't know.
I don't think they do.
Yeah, probably not.
No.
They just sit around and, you know, hang out with
and
their
families. Watch football.
Watch football. That's about it.
Yeah, I think we've just unlocked the secret to the success of football in America.
Brought it all around. Yeah. All right.
Full circle. Circle of life.
Oh, it's great.
Should we do a sponsor?
Yeah, let's do it.
Hover.com, domain management made simple. I'm going to give them that. You can probably remember a time when you've gone to register a domain name and you were upsold on things. You were almost forced into things. Maybe you thought you were signing up to register a domain for a year and somehow 2 years got selected and you didn't realize why until after you were done checking out. That's happened. Things like that happen all the time. But if you just want a simple, straightforward, honest way to register .com, .net, I like the .co, .tv, but they got all the TLDs over there. Hover makes it really easy to do it. You just enter the domain name that you want in the search box. Hover tells you if it's available. If it is, little plus button. Decide if you want the free Whois privacy protection. I always turn that on. And you're pretty much done. You can check out with a credit card or PayPal or whatever you feel like. And they make it incredibly, incredibly simple. They have a no-hold policy if you do need to call and talk to a person. They have this really cool free transfer valet service so that if you're transferring your domain name from one of the other folks and you want it to be over there at Hover, they'll do the whole thing for you, and they don't charge you for this. It's really, really cool. A human being does it, and it doesn't have to be you. They have a really nice DNS management system. They now do have been doing it for a while, email hosting. So if you're in that dilemma, like, wow, I have a new domain or new business, should I pay for Google Apps? I would say give these guys a try. It's pretty cool. You can learn more by going to hover.com/DanSentMe. And then it'll automatically give you 10% off everything you buy. If you're already a customer, if you're doing a transfer, if you want to do something else, just use the code DanSentMe at any point and you will get 10% off. So check them out. Support our last episode of the show in the network by going to hover.com/DanSentMe.
Got a lot of feedback last episode from the test-driven development discussion
yes.
at the beginning.
You were talking about development.
I was. My position then was basically, you know, somebody had written in asking, sorry, I forgot the name. You've written in asking about, you know, all these test-driven methodologies and whether I practice any of them and all this stuff. And you know, it was clear that this person worked in a very regimented environment that is very different from the way I work. And so I basically said that I don't know much about that and that to do the kind of work that I do, you don't really need to do it a lot of the time, and especially when you're working independently and on, you know, on little consumer apps like what I do. And got a lot of feedback from people basically saying that I misunderstood what TDD or test-driven development is about And I got a lot of other emails saying, oh my God, I completely agree. So it was very, very split. one of the things that the TDD people said a lot, almost everyone had this. It's like there's this joke among people who go to Phish concerts, where like almost everybody will say in almost the exact same words to somebody who's never been to a Phish concert before, "Oh, you have to go because this." I forget the guy's name. It's one of the guys. It's like, "Oh, he's the lighting guy, and he's like the fifth member of the band." And every single Phish concert fan has said that pretty much the exact phrase to at least one of the person who is on the fence about whether to go or not. And so in the same way that is so incredibly common, but nobody thinks it is, I'm not sure if the TDD people realized they were all telling me the exact same thing, which is that test-driven development is not only about testing, but it's about writing self-contained code that makes it easier to refactor and all this. Like, I got that from everybody. And, you know, that's writing self-contained blocks of code that are orthogonal to your other code. That's just good practice in general. That's just good programming practice. And I don't think that's exclusive to test-driven development. I think that's true of any methodology or whatever I'm doing, if you would call it a methodology, which I'm not sure I would. But that's just good practice. And so, you know, you can look at a lot of these methodologies that people like, and most of them contain lots of good practices, but you can take that and you can use it elsewhere. You don't have to be practicing this particular methodology or philosophy, to take this good trait from it that also exists in many others. And say, oh yeah, I should write code that's more modular and you know less interdependent on the other code in my app. That's just good practice. All right, another question from Dan Robertson. Marco, please quickly answer this before the show ends. Thanks, smiley face. You, Marco, pronounce stronger and longer differently than most Americans. That is, when most people say stronger, you instead pronounce it exactly as written, stronger. Is this an accent you picked up living in a certain region, the way a parent or teacher explicitly taught the pronunciation, or a conscious decision on your part to stick to the way these words are spelled as the guide for pronouncing such words? I've been curious about this for many months. A quick answer / discussion would really put my mind at ease. Merry Christmas! Exclamation point. Okay, so Dan. And,
too bad we can't get the email about how you read punctuation. Period.
I know, that's always a lot of fun. I got that from Something Awful. So I've had a weird background. I was raised by a mother from Brooklyn, but in Ohio. And then I lived in Pennsylvania, and now I live in New York. And my wife is from Long Island and has a little bit of that accent left. So I speak very strangely in many different ways. Not just that, but I have a lot of strange speaking habits that are unusual or non-standard. Which, by the way, I think it's hilarious that I've been podcasting for 2 years having all these strange speaking habits. But the longer and stronger, as opposed to longer and stronger, where you pronounce that hard G, I've always thought that the hard G pronunciation was itself the weird regional thing and not the typical. See, I think the typical pronunciation is the soft G, longer, stronger, right? Mm-hmm.
I've been trying to think about this since longer. Longer,
right, so you don't pronounce the hard G. Like I know what this guy's talking about. I've heard that. I've heard a lot
stronger.
Of people say that.
Stronger. Right. Sounds weird to me. And now, how
right.
do you say
but you've heard people say that too, right?
Sure. Oh yeah. Say water. Say that.
Water.
Water.
Yeah. But see, but I'm weird because I'm from the Midwest, but I've been exposed to so many New Yorkers in general that I'm slowly adapting a partial New York accent.
Well, this is from your, you know, the fact that you live in downtown Brooklyn.
Right. But I've always thought it was weird that something called downtown Brooklyn exists. But that's mostly historic. please email Dan.
Yeah.
I think the pronunciation authority to go to with something like this would be like to watch a newscaster or like a commercial voiceover. Because like there's like a TV accent that's like it's like the average proper way to speak, which is mostly based on a Midwestern accent. It lacks most of the regional taste or the regional accents and regional tweaks that exist in like certain cities and certain areas in the country. Mm-hmm. So I would say like however national news anchors pronounce these things is the correct American way to pronounce them. But I don't know what they say. We should find out. So please email Dan with the answer, and we'll address it on No Future Show.
So you're saying that the equivalent then in the U.S. of the Queen's English would be however news commentators pronounce things.
Right, but okay. Not Fox News, because they would only pronounce it one way.
Oh, by the way, some quick follow-up, since we won't have another opportunity. The view of the entire field that I was talking about is called All 22. Thanks to everyone on Twitter who told me that. It is called All 20. And, of course, now I remember it's called All 22. I've also heard it called Coach's Film. But usually All 22 is that's what I was trying to think of. Thank you.
Anytime. I've also put in the show notes, I forgot to mention in my test-driven development orthogonal code response. Yeah. That phrase, the phrase orthogonal code, I think, comes from the Pragmatic Programmer book. It's a book called The Pragmatic Programmer, From Journeyman to Master, or some stupid thing after the colon. I don't know why we have that stupid colon culture in book titles. title, colon culture. I put that in the show notes. It's a good... The Pragmatic Programmer is a really good book for pragmatic learning of this kind of stuff in the way that it's very short and it has a lot of good stuff in it. You know, relative to what it has in it, it's very short. So, like, everyone, there's like the set of books that every software engineer is supposed to have read to make them a better programmer, and one of them is Code Complete, and The Pragmatic Programmer, I think, is among that now. I never read Code Complete. I've had it for about a decade, I think. It's been sitting on my bookshelf. I have never read it because it's huge. And I always say, oh, I'm going to read that someday, and I never actually have. The Pragmatic Programmer is way shorter and way easier to read, I think, or way easier to get through, at least. So I recommend that strongly. Everything else you read is up to you. If you disagree with these statements, please email. I don't know. How about Jim Dalrymple? Let's throw some variety in here.
You
please
should email him. He replies to everything. Usually, almost every single reply is "Amen, brother." But otherwise, he does reply to pretty much everything.
That's great.
Yeah,
good for him.
Yeah.
Okay,
and Twitter too. And it can be as inflammatory as you want, or as kind as you want, and his response is always "Amen, brother."
Cool.
Yeah,
that guy's so cool.
I know.
All right. I'm going to plow through a few things quickly because I wanted to cover a lot in this last show. Another question from Brandon Toon. That's a cool last name, Toon. Before you leave, I would very much appreciate it if you could both spend some time discussing why it is or is not a good idea for someone to create and ship their first iOS app, given how mature the iOS/App Store world is now. In other words, being a newcomer, do I still have a shot at making a successful iOS app? I know that success is very subjective, but in my case, I define success as the app supplementing my income by generating a few hundred to $1,000 per month. All right. So, I think it's very... here's the thing about iOS. First of all, I think you can look at iOS as a extremely sizable market comparable to, say, the market for web apps. And I know the population size is very different between those things, but... Overall, I think iOS can support a lot of businesses, similar to how the web can support a lot of businesses. And so if you look at anything else in technology, new desktop software, new web apps, no one is saying, oh, you can't launch anything there anymore. It's done. You know, there's always potential for something new. People are always looking for new things. People are always looking for new alternatives to replace things they've used for years. And there's always new markets that will appear that didn't exist before. For instance, like app.net is a brand new service, relatively speaking. So there's now a complete market out there for app.net clients. That didn't exist 6 months ago or a year ago. Maybe it did 6 months ago, but it didn't exist a year ago. And so look at something like Clear is a great example. Clear, wow, my phone is...
What's happening over there? Screen.
I don't know. We have this Fios phone line.
Oh yeah, if people will remember when you got this Fios installed, you were required to have a phone line, so you have like an old fashioned Bell phone.
I think it's a Western Electric 500. It's like some classic phone that is from my mom's old apartment in Brooklyn. back before I was born. It's a very old phone. Anyway, the only thing that I ever get on that line is telemarketing. Verizon is the crappiest company on earth. Anyway, because it's all Verizon telemarketing. And there's no option I can put on this phone to end these stupid calls. So I'm probably just going to have to cancel the phone line entirely. And for, you know, for a gain of nothing per month. Anyway, look at an app like Clear, which is that to-do list app that you swipe everything and it's all orange. It's a great app. It was very successful. I believe they've made over a few hundred thousand dollars. It's a very, very successful app. And that came out at a time when OmniFocus was already out, Things was already out. There were a million to-do list apps on the App Store. But that came out and succeeded because it was different. It was new. Even though people already had to-do lists coming out their butt for years, there was still demand. There still is demand for that. And if you go and make another to-do list that somehow is different and useful to people, there's still a market for that, even in the most crowded category in the App Store, besides maybe games, of course. That's a whole different thing. So, you know, I would say that there's always room in this market. There's always room for something new. And a few hundred to $1,000 per month, as Brandon said in the email, that's really not that lofty of a goal for a market this big. I mean, you can make that pretty easily if you have an app that anybody really uses. You know, like I made with my nursing clock app, I made a total of like $70 because nobody used it. But once you get any momentum at all, if you have any momentum, you can make a few hundred dollars a month. I mean, that's not that hard in a market with like 300 million devices.
I mean, I think people, and this is going to sound like one of these responses that it sounds like you would get this out of a motivational self-help type book, and it because it's so cheesy.
Thanks.
But like, think big, think bigger. You know, I mean, maybe it's unrealistic to say, "Oh, I'm going to make $100,000 a month." Fine, but I think this is a great. There's never been a better time to be a developer than right now, ever in the history of anything. People can say, "Oh, well, back in the old days, if you built anything, people would come and buy it." Well, maybe that's true. I don't think so, because getting to market was so hard. And who cares?
Like we don't have to like get our stuff into Best Buy onto the store shelves.
Right. Like figure out. I remember the first company that I went to work for, we had these, we were building computer-based training stuff that was like, it would teach, like, here's how to use Microsoft Word. And it was like essentially an ancient version of like a screencast. And you would basically sit there and be taught like, click this to start a new document in Word. I mean, it was that kind of thing. And we were making these and we had like shrink wrapped products. And as part of when you were starting out working there, like you would spend a day down in the quote unquote warehouse, which was really just like a poorly air conditioned large room. And you were like shrink wrapping boxes and putting stuff together. And this was, you know, this was like the early 90s, mid 90s. And that was how you got a software product out into the world. Like websites were new and people knew you were going to get rich off the internet. They just weren't sure how, you know, and now like you can figure out how to write some code, come up with a cool idea and get something out in front of millions and millions of people, you know, from your apartment. And if that thing that you make is really cool, you can make a great living for a little while, anyway.
It's so easy to charge money now, too. You know, for the last decade or so, it really hasn't been. Well, I guess the App Store is now about 5 years old. But okay, for the decade before that, it really was not easy to charge money for anything. You know, on the web, you basically had to write your own thing or use PayPal and use these various credit card gateway services or merchant services like eCelerate and stuff like that. And there were all these people taking all these cuts. But the bigger problem was that nobody wanted to type in their credit card on the internet. And even the people who did want to type it in, it was very hard. It was a big multi-step process. Whereas on iOS, you know, we've talked about this many times in the show. On iOS, you just type in your password. Your stuff's already entered.
Yeah.
So it's so much easier for people to pay you that as a result, it's easier for you to make money. It's easier for you to charge money directly to the customers and have them buy it at a reasonable rate because it's so easier for them to buy it. And so, yeah, and now, especially in the world of iOS and the App Store, you can be a one-person shop and really get quite a lot done. You know, you can be a one-person shop and have that be your entire business, whereas that also, that was very rare in the past. There were a few people who could write successful shareware apps maybe in the past, but it was really a very small number of people. Now that number's way bigger because there is just, it's so easy for one person to do everything within the scope of what we have to do to make an app in the App Store. And even if there are things that you don't know how to do very well, like icon design, that's really easy to outsource. It's like a one-time thing for, you know, a few hundred bucks. Like, it isn't that much money, relatively speaking. So it really is very easy to be a one-person shop these days. And it's very important to recognize that trends like this in the market, you know, right now is the golden time. Well, maybe 2 years ago might have been a little bit more golden time when there was less competition in the App Store. But, you know, there right now is a golden time to be in this economy. Just like, you know, 2005 was a fantastic time to be in web apps. You know, so and now, though, I think web apps are declining. And I know that's a very unpopular opinion. But honestly, I really do believe that web apps are, you know, it's, they're not going to like die, you know, in tech news parlance. They're not going to be killed by anything. But I just think they're declining in their importance. They're declining in the growth that happens there. There's a lot of consolidation happening. Like, social is becoming increasingly tight with Facebook and Twitter and nobody else. You know, like, and Apple is locking down a lot of the device end of things. And like, there's all these, everything's being consolidated into these bigger and bigger massive mega powers. Google steamrolls over anything they enter. You know, any market they enter, with the exception of the smartphone profitable market, which they've partially steamrolled over, but not as much as they usually do. Like think about like how many web calendar apps there were before Google Calendar came out, and how many have come out afterwards.
I mean,
you know, like, yeah, it's like there's, when Google walks into something, they walk into it basically flattening everybody in the same way that Walmart flattens local stores by coming in with some giant mega store offering a selection and convenience under one roof that no local merchant can compete with in most places, and then bring the prices down to rock bottom so that there's no profit left for anybody else to charge anything to sustain themselves. That's what Google does on the web. And for some reason, everyone hates Walmart and loves Google. But that's what they do on the web. They come in and they come into a market and they crush anything else that's there because they have way more resources to throw at the problem. They can do something way bigger and more complex, and they can give it to everybody for free. And so that crushes the market for lots of things. So, you know, the web market is really hard to get a foot in. It's really hard for for somebody new to come in, unless you're doing something that's so on the fringes that the big guys won't care about it, won't be interested in going to that market. But if that's the case, if it's that far on the fringes, then it isn't a big, very big market for you to begin with. So it's so that it becomes harder then in that way that it's just a smaller market. So, you know, the web is today not that friendly of a place to launch something new. Whereas apps are still very fresh. And eventually the app market will shift as well. Eventually the app market will become less friendly to newcomers. You can see that's the trend in the long term, but I think we're still probably a good 5 years away from that. And then I don't know what happens in 5 years. Something else will start happening there probably. You know, we have these roughly decade-long eras in computing. Of like, you know, what matters the most in this decade. And in the 2000s, in like 98 to 2008 or so, it was the web. It was web apps, websites, social web stuff, all that stuff. And then like from, you know, 2009 or so until probably 2019, it's mobile and apps. And then we'll see what happens after that. We don't know yet. Generally speaking, if you want to if you want to have the most exciting time, if you want to have the most career development possible, and if you want to make the most money possible or have the biggest chance of making a lot of money, you need to be in that area of tech that is the current new thing, especially if you can get into it pretty early. That's why, like, you know, right today, I would think working on a website would be a pretty boring job. I did that for so long that I don't really want to work on a website anymore. That to me would be like, you know, in 2005 working on Microsoft Office, you know, like imagine that. But in 2005, working on a website was awesome.
Oh, yeah.
I loved it because that was the place to be. That was where everything was happening. And,
but it you know, it's interesting because if you had said to somebody back then, you know, all this stuff you're doing now is going to be eclipsed by this other thing that people are going to walk around with in their pockets. But there would have been no way to get the jump on that. You know what I mean? Like, there was no way to start imagining it or thinking about it because things change so much. And it makes you wonder, like, you can't really see. I mean, if you look back at the Dick Tracy comics, you know, that's the life we're pretty much living now.
I've seen that.
Even a few years ago, if you were to tell people how much time they would spend using their smartphone, how omnipresent it would be, how totally connected to this thing and to the world through this thing you would be. I mean, I wouldn't have believed it. And I was into this kind of stuff.
Well, and oftentimes the significance of things shifts after they've come out. I mean, smartphones were around for, you know, a solid 5 years before, like good, usable smartphones. Well, varying definitions of good and usable, but like passable smartphones were around for a good 5 years or so before the iPhone came out.
Mm-hmm.
And you could buy and sell software on them. People did, you know, there was software back in the Palm days for the Palm Pilot. Like there was third party software market for that, but it was a really small market.
Yeah.
And it was really hard for people to buy software and install it. So, you know, the market was very, very small. And, you know, overall those devices were never really mainstream. Although I had one in high school because I was that much of a nerd. But and I still maintain that the Palm 5X that I had is one of the best portable devices that was ever made, even by today's standards.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway, so, you know, this market for smartphone apps was around before the iPhone, but it was just so small because the smartphones weren't very good yet and distribution was very difficult. It was just so small that it didn't really matter in the grand scheme of things. And then this radical shift happened with the iPhone and with the App Store. And then all the follow-on effects, even people who didn't buy iPhones, and eventually Android, you know, caught up by cloning iOS and made its own market of things that can't make any money. And it's, you know, and now we have tablets where that was a market that sucked for a while. And then the iPad came out and changed that. And now everyone's following on with that. So now there's all these tablets you can buy for very little money that can do quite a lot. So, you know, these things shift. And so in the future, I think, for instance, I heard you mention, I think it was on the crossover with Gina and Jason. I think it was that one. I heard sometime recently, I heard you mention about how, you know, you think podcasts are the future of listening to audio in cars.
Totally.
And I think you're right. You know, I think podcasts are actually going to have the same kind of explosion in a few years. I really do think, and it's smart of you to be here, to be positioning yourself now to be ideally placed when that explosion happens. Because, you know, I see right now, we've had internet streaming radio, you know, with Shoutcast, and like we've had that for over a decade.
Oh yeah,
that is not even close to new.
Right.
We've had podcasts for about a decade now too, or almost a decade. Right. Like when did Apple put that into iTunes? That's kind of when it started for most people.
Yeah, I think that was around. Gosh, I should know this off the top of my head, but
when was Twitter founded?
Yeah, I think that was probably
so
around
like 2003 or 2004, maybe.
No, I think it was after that. I'll find out while we continue to talk. But I do think that it was after that because I remember what a big deal that was. The fact that you could submit. Yeah, and I did. I had the Hive Logic radio show, my little interview. I interviewed Brent Simmons, for among others.
Like I remember it was a big deal when my RSS client, which at the time was Newsfire by Dave Watanabe, which I love that client, but it never joined the syncing revolution. But it was a big deal when Newsfire added support for downloading enclosures.
Yeah, right.
It became a very early podcast client, like right before iTunes added it. But anyway, so, you know, so podcasting has been around in, you know, in pretty widespread use for almost a decade now.
Yeah.
But it's still kind of this fringe that only nerds, well, not nearly as much as it used to be, I guess, but it's still kind of this fringe. Like our parents, well, yours might, but my parents and grandparents, like, they still don't know what podcasts are. They've never heard that word before.
Okay, version 4.9 of iTunes, released on June 28th, 2005, added built-in support for podcasts.
All right.
And you could enter in your own, you could enter in your the URL right there. And then they came out with the podcast directory, which was, that was the big...
That changed everything.
Oh, man. That was big.
So podcasts now are I think, about to explode in a way. You know, it's one of these things where, again, like in the past, it's been a market so far. It's been getting slowly bigger and bigger, like smartphone software was before the iPhone. But podcasts have not had that iPhone moment yet. And I think what will change that is a combination of two things happening in cars right now. One really obvious one is internet connectivity. I don't think the future is having cars that have their own cellular modems and their own data plans. There are cars that offer that, usually very high-end cars, but I don't think that's really the future. I think the future is very clear. It's really the present, which is the cars being able to take advantage of your cell phone, of your smartphone, and your smartphone having a data connection. That, I think, is here to stay.
Yeah.
Having a smartphone in your pocket with data connection is, I think, going to persist for the rest of our lives. That, I don't think, is going away. And so, you know, whether the smartphone continues to be like the tethering modem for everything, maybe not. You know, maybe some of your devices get their own modems. But I think using your smartphone as a data connection to the rest of the world, until each device has its own data connection, and for some that might never happen, I think that is extremely common now, and it's going to become even more common in the future. So you get into your car right now, many cars support USB jacks to plug your phone in. Now, and that's now almost universal among car models for the last 5 years or so. What's happening though now is many of them are getting Bluetooth integration, and not just for the speakerphone. That's speakerphone Bluetooth has been around for longer, but a lot of them are getting Bluetooth audio support and Bluetooth dialing support, and dial up networking support. Lots of advanced connectivity happening there, and we're getting these systems as these things get more common and cheaper. We're getting lots more cars that have whole built-in touch screens or navigation screens for navigation systems. That's becoming way more common because it's way cheaper now. Mm-hmm. It, you know, 5 years ago, if you wanted navigation in your car, you were paying $5,000 extra for it.
Yeah, isn't that crazy?
Now it comes in a lot of cars standard, and even more cars, it comes as a way less expensive option than it used to be. So, and it's available on more models than it ever was before. In fact, I think it wouldn't surprise me. I think the government wants to make it. I know they were trying to legislate so that backup cameras were required. I don't know if that went anywhere, but it wouldn't surprise me if within the next decade, navigation systems became required in cars.
Yeah,
like that wouldn't surprise me at all.
Yeah, so, I mean, like my car has the, like you're talking about, it's got the, you know, built-in Wi-Fi and that kind of thing, and it's like, it's just weird when you think about that is becoming something that is just the simply standard. It's just expected. And today, it's not so much like, it's not an exciting feature for people, but it's the fact that that kind of thing is being integrated. Like, I've got the backup camera, which is really handy. And the other day, so I went, you know, we have this minivan, which you'll be getting one soon. I figure that's probably why you wanted to end the show, because your wife has demanded one. And you don't want to have to publicly talk about it. But it's just a theory. It's a theory. But, you know, and like the other day, I got in and I was driving somewhere with the whole family in there. And I'm like, wait a minute. Like, you have to turn the key to start the key. You don't just put the key in. You have to turn the key. And I'm like,
that's one of those things like if you have let's say you have three bathrooms in your house and two of them have a soft closed toilet seat.
Right. And then I'm like, wait a minute, like the parking brake, you don't just push a button, like you get to stomp your foot down and you hear a little grinding sound. Really? You had to do that? All right, let's back up. Wait a minute. I got to look in the mirror? This is what? Where am I? This feels like, you know, maybe I need to crank the car to get it to start up too. You know, what's next?
And obviously it's different for us because we have asshole cars. But you know what? You don't even have to bleep that. It's the final episode. Who cares?
Yeah, who cares?
You know, you and I drive asshole cars, but these things are filtering down to mainstream market cars too.
Yeah.
And so anyway, so the point of all that is like people are getting internet connected cars in a way, you know, in this roundabout way, not that the cars themselves have modems most of the time, but that they have their phones in their pockets.
Right.
And their car can communicate with the phone, often over Bluetooth, so mm-hmm. it's even easier, and there's even fewer wires to worry about going obsolete. They're communicating with the phone and able to use that phone's software and able to use that phone's internet connection. And so, like, I don't know how it works in regular cars yet, but BMW has this thing called BMW Apps, where apps can register with them and use some SDK to be fully integrated into the nav screen and use all the nav controls. And so you basically create, it's like a second screen for the app with a custom interface that's just for displaying on BMW and Mini models. And you can, so you could, I could write, like I've often thought if I make this podcast client that I keep talking about making someday, I've often thought I would try to get into that developer program so I could have it natively in the car for these two brands.
Mm.
And that's, you know, that's a very limited thing. But over time, I think we're going to see a similar thing happen in car computing as we saw in other computing markets, where at first everyone's kind of doing their own thing. And there's a million different computing platforms out there competing and that are incompatible with each other. But then eventually, you know, somebody licenses something to somebody else. And then there's these collaborations. You know, you already have Microsoft working with Ford and you know, Apple working with God knows who to get iPod support and everything else, mm-hmm. iPhone support. But, you know, I think there's going to be these standards. That's like Bluetooth is one, of course, and for doing what it does. Pretty soon, you'll be able to write software that can run in a clever, creative way from your smartphone that will work with your car's controls to, right. to be able to display stuff in your car and use your car's controls in a smart way that's less buggy than the track forward, track back controls. And so we're entering a time when it'll be really easy to have software running in cars that we can all write, that can run on not just one model of car, but on many cars. And you'll have internet connectivity. And satellite radio sucks. I'm telling you.
It's that thing in a few years. I mean, satellite radio, I don't know if there's any future in there, but that's the thing is that regular radio, I can see the value for listening to regular radio to get up to the minute reports on, for example, traffic, maybe breaking news, maybe live sports. Other than that, those two, three things, and I could only really strongly argue for two of those things. That's it. People are not going to listen to music on the radio anymore. People are certainly not going to listen to talk on the regular radio. They're going to listen to it when they're ready to listen to it. Or maybe they'll listen to it live, be surprised by some content, but mostly it's going to be in whatever we think of as podcasts today, whatever that continues to morph and evolve into, that's what people are going to be tuning in to listen to.
And I should point out too, smackfoo_ in the chat room has said, has Marco ever had satellite radio? Probably in that tone.
Please,
too.
Please.
I have been a satellite radio customer for about 10 years.
You're like the poster child for satellite radio.
I first had XM in, I think, 2002 was when I first bought it. And I had it for a couple of years. And then when Howard Stern announced that he was going to Sirius, I sold my XM stuff and switched to Sirius. This was before the merger, of course.
Right. Then you bought it all back.
Since then.
Yeah.
And I had one Sirius radio for a while, and then I switched to car plus internet for the house. And man, they have a terrible app. The problem with SiriusXM, now one merged company, is that they really, really don't get the internet at all. Like they are horrible with how they work with the internet, how they deal with the internet. Their app is terrible. Like if you actually try to use their app, it's one of those things where like after some number of minutes, it'll put up an alert saying do you want to keep listening? Click OK if you do. And if you don't click OK within a minute or two, it just disconnects the stream. So you can't just like have it playing in a room and forget about it and just listen. Like, you have to go over and hit this button every so often.
So bad. So bad.
So, and the sound quality on satellite radio is abysmal. I wrote a thing.
Can I do the next sponsor while you dig for it? Shutterstock.com.
Well, not yet. We got to finish that up.
Big Dan. We got to talk about Shutterstock. We got to talk about image resolution too.
Oh, is this about my tweets?
Well, yeah, and it's a sponsor. Figured we'd talk about it.
All right, good. So, yeah, I'm talking about that. Anyway, you know, satellite radio, the sound quality is terrible. The programming is decent in some ways. It's okay in some ways, and it's crappy in some ways. Their music channels tend to have pretty small playlists. And not all the channels are this bad, but they tend to have, like, you're going to hear a lot of repeated songs on those channels. And so, you know, it's okay. It's not great. Satellite radio was great 10 years ago when I got it. You know, relative to what you could get then, it was great. And it's great now because there's Howard Stern on there, which, you know, so there's exclusive content I want to listen to. So I buy, you know, for the same reason a lot of people buy cable TV, because there's something they want to watch there that you can't really get outside of that environment. But Howard Stern's probably going to end his show in 2 or 3 years when his contract's up.
That's the end. Mark my words. If Sirius isn't dead by then, that's the nail in the coffin.
Right. And Sirius doesn't think so. You know, Sirius is all like, you can tell by a lot of what's happened with them and by a lot of the commentary you hear from Howard on the air. You could tell that Sirius as a company does not realize how many people subscribe just for Howard.
Yeah.
Like, they really
or maybe
that.
They do realize it and they're scared. They should be scared. And I would be scared too.
Yeah. So, like, you know, Sirius, I would say in 3 years when Howard presumably leaves, Sirius takes a pretty big dip. And then I don't know if they'll go out of business anytime soon after that, but it will certainly hurt a lot. And so anyway, so right now, Sirius is very, very artificially boosted by all these integrations they have in cars. All of these, you know, cars that come with a free, you know, 3 months or 6 months or a year of Sirius that have it built in, because now it's so cheap, the car manufacturers offer it as a basic luxury thing, you know, pay an extra X dollars and you get Sirius for a while.
Right.
A lot of people have Sirius in their cars. But then when that free trial subscription ends, it's a lot harder to keep it going, to keep motivated to keep it going if you have a smartphone that's internet connected in your pocket. And if you have like something like Pandora or Spotify or Ardio to supply you with music, or you just have your own music from your playlist, from iTunes, from everything. Like,
right.
First iPods were a pretty big competitor to satellite radio, just by being able to bring your whole library with you so easily. Now you have the combination of having your library with you and having all this other streaming stuff from the internet, streaming radio stations that are so commonplace, so cheap, and getting really good. And so you have that now. And I really think that the software integration that can happen in the future will enable podcasts to really break in. So you have this perfect storm of stuff to not only make satellite radio really irrelevant, and as for FM and HD radio, which is a joke, my car has HD radio. Which is kind of annoying because if I'm in an area with an HD radio station, it will automatically switch to that if it can. But then, like, every 30 seconds, it'll switch back and forth because it drops the signal for HD, and yeah, it's a mess. Anyway, commercial radio is dead. I mean, it's so dead. And satellite radio is dying. It's going to be dead very soon. All being replaced by the internet. So that's going to be, this is a very long way of saying, that's going to be a great place to be in the podcast business in the next 5 years. That's going to be a great place to be. And that's, I'm not saying podcasts are going to replace apps. I mean, it's not that level of importance and of market size. But, you know, it's important to recognize, this is my big picture talk here, it's important to recognize major shifts like this when they are either beginning to happen or right before they're going to happen. And it's very hard to recognize them before they're going to happen, but you can at least recognize them when they're beginning to happen. You can see that something big is moving there that's going to be big in a few years, or that's about to explode, or that is exploding now, and it's going to explode a lot more over the next 5 years. Generally speaking, in your career as a programmer, it is very exciting to be in those, movements at the right time. And I was fortunate enough to be at Tumblr when that was exploding, and it still is, of course, but you know, I was fortunate enough to be there when that was happening, and I was fortunate enough to be in the app economy as that was exploding.
Yeah.
And it's been awesome. It has been absolutely awesome. And, you know, I don't know what my future in podcasting holds. This show needs to end because, you know, even though we've had this episode and last episode have been very good, I think the last two have been good because it was ending. and I knew that. And so I changed things up a little bit. This show, you know, it's good to end this, clear this away, make room for something new. And I do want to do something new. I don't know what that's going to be yet. You know, I know a lot of people are speculating that I'm going to, you know, jump to Mule Radio or something like that. I don't have any plans like that. I don't have any immediate or any foreseeable plans to jump to some other network. I want to have a future in podcasting, but I don't know what that's going to be yet. And it really is what I said. I want to take a break and just, you know, regroup and then kind of experiment and see what I want to do, because this is not a world I want to leave. I just want to change it up a bit.
I think a lot of people are happy to hear that. I'm happy to hear that.
Thank you.
But you will, I'm sure, announce somewhere.
I'll figure it out. Yeah.
All right. Hold you to it. And we can talk about, there's a topic embedded in this sponsor, Shutterstock. Okay, so Shutterstock.com, you'll find over 20 million stock photos, vectors, illustrations, video clips. You go to Shutterstock.com, you start searching for stuff. Merlin did a couple examples because he's comic obsessed. So he searched for like comics and superheroes and stuff like that. Found a whole bunch of cool stuff. He puts them in a light box and he can share them with everyone. He can see the images that he picked out. This works really well if you're doing a project. Works really well if you're collaborating with other people. They also have an iPad app that lets you do all this, put everything together, organize it. And so as we've told you, and this is leading up to our topic maybe, is that they give you the high resolution images. They don't nickel and dime you. They let you get the big stuff, the good stuff, whether it's a vector illustration, whether it's a video clip, it doesn't matter what it is. If you have something where you need some kind of visually creative thing, and you're not a visually creative person like me, I'm not, this is where you go. And you can sign up for a free browse account. You just go to Shutterstock.com. No credit card needed, nothing like that. When you find the images or the vectors or the video clips that you're ready to purchase, use the code DanSentMe12. DanSentMe12. And you'll get 30% off any package. Doing this is a great way to support 5x5 and the show. And a great way to save some money, Shutterstock.com. Check them out. Now, you were on this quest, Marco. You want some kind of super duper, like high resolution, but you want to use it on screen. Is that the issue? Because you're trying to, I'm guessing, Yes. Do something for a retina display. That's what I'm guessing.
Right. It's for the magazine. You know, I want to occasionally be able to use licensed photos for articles in the magazine. You know, I'm paying writers. I'm paying editors, you know, I'm paying illustrators. I need something for photos. And in some cases, I'll be able to go directly to photographers and commission them or license some of their stuff. In many cases, I'm not going to have the time for that, or it'll be impractical to get it by the deadline, or it'll just cost way too much to have something shot in a particular thing just for this article. So I'm fine using stock or commercial photography from Right. Places like Shutterstock and Getty and things like that. So, but most of them have limits on the resolution that you can use digitally, because they don't want people to be able to easily copy their images. So, you know, like I looked, and I've been talking to Shutterstock, to somebody there, to see if we can work this out, and we probably will be able to. But many of these restrictions were implemented and codified in their licenses before Retina screens existed. So, like, I think Shutterstock's is 800 by 600 officially. And then there's some other plan where you can get 1200 by 800, something like that. But, you know, these things, this is great for the web 5 years ago, but now with retina screens, you have to double everything. And if you show an 800 by 600 image on a retina iPad, it's going to look like crap.
Yeah.
So my challenge is I'm trying to find either a license with Shutterstock mm-hmm. or something with somebody else where I can get high resolution images that I can use at least 2048 pixels wide.
And then that's it's interesting because these high resolution screens, the Retina displays, are really pushing the limits of this infrastructure of send. You know, the fact is that if we didn't have the kind of bandwidth and the kind of connectivity that we have, whether it's with LTE on the mobile side or whether it's with the Fios connections or really fast cable modems that we have nowadays, nobody would be happy with a Retina display, anything, because we wouldn't, you know, you think about, I remember when I used to do, like, remember Playground, or I don't know if you remember that site I used to do. Whenever I was getting images for that thing, I would always have to tweak them and, you know, was very concerned about download sizes. Like, there was that threshold when you're exporting a JPEG where how small can I get that file to be? Because I did every single one of those images by hand. How small can I get this file to be and still have it look decent? Oh, a Retina display screws all that up. And now you have all these places that for years, like Shutterstock, that have been, you know, have this huge catalog of images. You can get them in these higher resolutions with, like, their enhanced license. But that's typically the only who would do anything but print that? Like, that's the only reason you would get the enhanced license, of course, because you're going to be printing this. That's why else would you need it in 3700 by 5616 or whatever, you know? It's a weird place to be in, and these companies like this are working on getting caught up to it, but it's going to take time.
Right. Anything that involves changing the terms to something that involves a whole bunch of people's copyrights is complicated and time consuming and very expensive. So I don't expect this to change quickly. It's interesting, you know, all the restriction of, like, okay, we're going to make it so that if you use this on a website, it's limited to 800 by 600 so that if people copy it, like, the idea of that is if people save that image from the website, that they can't then use it to make prints very well.
Right.
Because it's too low resolution to make prints. Well, now there's been these two major shifts. One, I think, is that a lot fewer people are printing things with these images. I would bet, I don't know this for sure, but I would bet that a lot more of the stock business's business mm-hmm. is digital than it used to be. I don't know that for sure, though.
Yeah, I think you're onto something.
So first of all, it's like, well, if you copy it at 8x6, then you can still put it up on your website at that resolution. And then, like, and, you know, they can find you and send you a cease and desist, but, or a DMCA takedown. But, you know, like they're trying to make it so that you can't steal something that you can really use. But in reality, if you steal it off a website, you can just put it up on your website and it looks the same.
Yeah.
So that's one problem. The other problem is that the Retina displays are actually, if you have something that looks good on Retina, that's actually better than you need for print in many cases. Like for many different things you could be printing, if you steal something from a website that is Retina resolution and you try to make a print from it, it will look great. Because in many situations, a Retina screen is actually higher resolution than most printers could print.
Isn't that crazy? I mean, if you've got like an inkjet, forget it.
And all these other printers these days are like, you know, 6,000 DPI. Believe me, that's not what you actually get on most paper most of the time.
No.
With actual, you know, actual ink spread and what's the thing? Oh,
toner. Toner.
No. The thing when they pixelate to make different colors, when they mix the pixels, dithering. That's it. You know, once you look at what you actually get resolution from these printers, you actually aren't exceeding, you know, 300 or 600 DPI a lot of the times.
Yeah.
But so yeah, like it's a weird, like, this has to be weird for people like stock photo people who, you know, for so long their business was probably mostly print and the web was this kind of backwater that, you know,
right. And then to say, hey, we can make these really low resolution versions of these things and put those out there.
Right, exactly.
And all of a sudden they're like, wait a minute, I guess we gotta go back to the high res ones. But it does change. It is an interesting kind of a fine line, because if you're getting, at least up until a Retina display, if you were getting the high resolution one, let's be honest, like, you're going to print this. You know what I mean? There's no other reason that
you're not
going
to put that on the web. You're not going to put like a 12 meg image on the web.
No. And then it, because the bandwidth, there isn't the bandwidth for it, number one. And number two, no one can see that. Might as well make it 72 DPI. Well, now it has created a kind of this strange in-between place of, well, maybe you are getting it to put it out on the web. And I think it confuses people. And it confuses the people at the companies. What are they supposed to do? And I don't think there's an easy answer, because if you release a version that is that really, really high quality, high resolution one, and the only mechanism that you've had to release it has been through the enhanced license, because obviously you need that license if you're going to print it, which is the only thing you could possibly be doing with something that is such a high resolution, well, then you're going to pay a little bit more to get that kind of a license. But why should you pay that more if you really don't? You know, and then there's a whole issue of, now all of a sudden your website is a distribution mechanism. In other words, you have the high resolution because you want to push the high resolution to serve the people who have the Retina displays, but that means you have the high resolution version, and that means someone could just download it and print it, which is what they're trying to avoid. So it's a weird area.
Yeah.
I don't know if there's an answer. What have you found so far in your like, as you're narrowing things down?
Shutterstock and iStock both have similar limits. Shutterstock I'm talking to maybe get a special license, and Getty and Corbis, I can't find their limits. They might not actually restrict, but I don't know. Anybody from Getty or Corbis, I would love to hear from you on whether, you know, if I use one of your images in my iPad app, can I use it at 2048 pixels wide? Or is there some kind of limit where can I use it on the website? Because, you know, the magazine also has a website, and I'm not planning on doing that much with it yet, but you know, I might want to just, I'm like, or, you know, what if I want to use one of these as a cover image for an issue?
Right.
I have to display that on the website. And that has to also be displayed in iTunes. And iTunes requires that image to be at least 1024 pixels on the long side. So, like, there's all sorts of problems with this. Like, I think resolution limits themselves are, you know, like, the idea of this was to be, like, phase one of preventing piracy of their images. You know, like they couldn't really, you could still copy this image off the website, but at least it wouldn't be that good of a version. At least you couldn't make prints with it. Right. That was the idea. But then they always had this backup of going around and trying to find copyright infringement of their images somehow, and then and pursuing that as like their little police force. I think in this current age, I think the former first line of defense of restricting what people can do with it digitally can no longer apply, that because that's going to, like, right now, any place like this that won't let me put a 2048 pixel wide image, I can't be their customer. I literally can't, because I'm not going to pay a premium for an image that looks like crap on my primary reading device, which is the iPad.
Right.
Like, I'm not going to, like, that does not work for my business. So, and the number of businesses where this applies is only going to increase. So eventually, they're going to have to stop enforcing limits that are so low. And if you're, let's say you raise the limit. Let's say you say, okay, you can do up to 2560 by 1600. Well, that's big enough that you can make prints from that. So, as I said, so like, then what's the point of having the limit at all if people can get such a great version of that image within the terms of the license? So I think ultimately the enforcement has to just more completely rest on their copyright infringement detection and private, you know, like their little policing force of that. They just have to give up the idea that they can protect everything through this one term of, oh, you can't do more, you can't make it bigger than this, and just instead rely on the infringement detection.
Yeah.
And this, by the way, as Palamondo points out in the chat, this is very similar to the problems of embedding fonts in apps. You know, they faced a lot of the same challenges there, where like for a long time, font foundries, the way they would prevent fonts from being too widely pirated, although I think fonts have always been very widely pirated.
Oh, yeah.
But because they're so small.
Yeah, don't,
so
easy. Let no one be naive about this. Fonts right. are like the most pirated thing probably still. Even I would think beyond, probably even second to like music. Way
maybe
more
e-books,
than movies.
Because e-books are really small.
Yeah, yeah.
But I'd say it's on the level of e-books.
Yes, for sure.
Music is probably bigger still, but and video might even be bigger now.
You think
but
video is probably bigger now? I can see that.
I think movies and TV shows are probably bigger now.
All right.
But and not just by bytes, you know, but by quantity. I wouldn't sure. surprise me if that's bigger than music. Because music is kind of fading out of popularity these days.
Well, you with know, stuff
like
with
music is music is no longer like the cool thing everyone has to have and what everyone like. I mean, people will always listen to music, but I think music is no longer like the, it's no longer like the pop culture medium anymore.
Yeah, no, you're right about that. That's interesting.
I think now it's TV and movies.
Yeah.
And software and social stuff and web stuff, you know? But yeah, you know, fonts are the same problem where, you know, they were so long depending on just don't let this file get out. And that was their defense and it didn't work very well. And you know, now if you have an app that embeds fonts, you have to embed that font file in the app, and in most cases, it's unencrypted. On some systems, it has to be unencrypted to work.
Yeah. Yeah.
On iOS, you can encrypt it, but it's relatively there's no good reason to if you aren't required to by your font license because it's slow and complicated. So they had to adapt. The font people had to adapt to this new model, and the photo agencies have to adapt too. All right, I think we're ready to close it up. We're out of sponsors, right?
Oh, we have one more.
Oh, we do. All right, do one more.
You want to do it?
Yeah.
SourceBits, SourceBits.com, suitable, I think, and fitting for our final episode because these guys, they make mobile apps, and that's been the topic of every one of these episodes is how to make mobile apps and do mobile app development, right? All along, that's been our theme. So that's what these guys do. But they do, they actually do, and they do a really good job of it. If you have an idea for an application, for a game, whatever it is, they have 300 dedicated programmers and interface designers that they can put as many of them as necessary behind your project full time. Maybe you need one, maybe you need 10, maybe you need all 300. They can do it. And they stand behind the idea that when you focus on brilliant design, that your product becomes your marketing and your customers become your advertising. Makes sense. They do stuff for the iPhone, iPad, Android, even BlackBerry, Facebook, you name it. They do it. And they can integrate all of these different tools together so that they can build you a complete solution. What they call an end-to-end product strategy. So you have an idea and you say, well, I also need a web back end and I need this and I need that. They can build it. They can make it all work together. And they really do know what they're doing. And they're fantastic people who I've met and they're super cool. You can go to sourcebits.com to learn more. And when you do, you can click the work link and you'll see how many of the apps that you may already be using that they've built that have been, I think they've had 20 of them reach the top 10 in global application marketplaces. So go check them out. Longtime sponsor of ours, sourcebits.com. Check them out.
All right. So basically, you know, it's hard for me to wrap this up in a way that I'm going to be proud of forever.
I was wondering what you were going to do. I've been sitting here thinking like the last week, like how do you do that?
Well, I've decided not to even try to do that.
Oh.
You know, kind of Seinfeldian, like, you know, don't even try to have a fantastic ending to the show. You know, like I didn't want to have this show be anything different. I wanted it to just be an episode of my show, you know, very similar to the other episodes. And it has been. And so I'm very happy with that. So I wanted to end with a question that I wanted to ask somebody a long time ago and never got a chance to. Well, first of all, one more point, if I can.
Sure.
Down from the depths of my topic list was sitting down there forever. Designers, : have one. And I can't emphasize enough how important it is for programmers to become friends with a designer and be able to hire a designer for help with your apps. We often do not realize how ugly and hideous our apps are. And it really helps a lot when you can have somebody else looking at that and saying, you know, this could be a lot easier to look at if you just made these changes. And you know, and obviously I know design goes beyond appearance. But that certainly is a big first step. And there are so many apps I download from the App Store. So many apps where I download it and I'm like, oh, this is so bad. Like, nobody looked at this. Nobody thought, oh, you know, can we add a little bit of spacing around this text? Maybe. Mm-hmm. Even some of my favorite apps, I'm not going to name names right now, but even some of the apps I use most often have like really bad design decisions in some ways. And it's just like, you know, this screen, like there's no spacing around that. The text is really hard to read. Why do they use three different fonts on the screen? Like there are so many, or you know, the icon is so bad on some of these things. So
It's the first thing people see.
Yeah. Like there's so much that a designer can help with. And I look back at Instapaper and I can't look at it. Like I really, like the same way that I can't listen to the show. Like I can't listen to my own podcast because I become too critical of myself. I can't look back at Instapaper's old versions. It's like, I challenge you to find a screenshot of Instapaper Pro, back when it was called that, Instapaper Pro 1.3, which was the first version of Instapaper Pro, I think. It's amazing. Like, it's so hideous. And I'm so ashamed that I shipped that.
Oh, come on now.
But over time, I built up both a sense for design a little bit and also a willingness to bring in outside help on that front. Because for a while, I was like, I'm going to do everything myself. I didn't want to spend the money. I didn't want to go through the hassle of finding designers. And good design is not that cheap, and it's not that easy to find, but it's so worth it. It is so worth it. It can make such a big difference. Look at Instapaper, especially older versions of it, and then look at the magazine. That's the difference designers can make. Believe me, it's a huge, huge difference. And now, what I really want to do is really blow away so much of Instapaper's interface and redo it. And I'm trying to figure out exactly how to do that right now. But that's, I would love to do that because believe me, even looking at Instapaper, every single time I'm reading something in Instapaper, especially on the iPad, and I tap something and I see that stupid navy blue popover frame or the navy blue gradient background on an action sheet. Oh my God. That's so incredibly dated. I can't stand looking at that. Like, and so much of the app was designed by programmer, which any designer knows can recognize. Most programmers don't realize that this is such a problem. Believe me, it's a problem. You need to fix it. I would say a designer is some of the best money you can spend. If you're going to outsource anything, a designer is by far the best money you can spend. Way better than advertising, for instance. I don't know. Advertising works a lot for a lot of different things. I don't think it works very well for iOS apps. Just because you tend to pay a lot more per listener or viewer of that ad than what you can make back in the store, based on app store prices. But like if you have to decide, but let's say you want to invest like $2,000 into making your app really awesome, are you going to go buy an app for $2,000? Are you going to hire a designer for $2,000? I spent a lot of money on ads. Believe me, the designer is the better choice there. So that's one thing. The other thing I wanted to end with is just kind of an inspirational thing, and with all apologies to Marlin, just think about this. If you got fired today, let's say at the end of this day, your boss discovered that you were listening to this show all day and decides to fire you instead of dealing with that. Or if you're somewhere where your boss won't let you listen to this show and that bugs you. or if you're somewhere where you really want to do a podcast and the guy you're doing it with will only do it during business hours and your boss won't let you do that ever during his business hours. let's say you have that kind of situation.
Yeah, coming. Wonderful situation.
What would you do if you were fired today? Like if your job, or if you were laid off, even in the nicest possible way, even if you got like a nice California send off, like, oh, sorry, we're making these changes in the organization and we're going to move forward and blah, 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 blah. This ship is leaving without you, basically, is the gist of it. So if you were fired today, what would you do? What would you work on next? And more importantly, why aren't you doing that now? So I think that's it. I think we're done.
A very positive way to end it.
Thank
actually,
you.
Inspirational even. Well, can I say something before we close down?
Yeah.
Well, I want to thank you because doing this show with you, it's been great fun. It's been a privilege, and it's absolutely been one of the highlights for me of building and creating 5x5. And you've been a big part of it.
Thanks. I've really enjoyed it myself. I really have looked forward to this every week.
Me
and
too.
It was a very hard decision to end this show. It really was. It was. I've been weighing it for months, before I decided. It was a very hard decision. And I have a feeling this will not be our last venture.
I hope not. And I know, you know, on behalf of the listeners, thanks for doing it. Because I know there's tons of people who are, you know, who've been along for the whole ride. And they loved it. They loved, if they loved listening to it half as much as I think we love doing it, then they're getting an idea of how much we'll all miss it. But thanks, Marco. Thanks for doing it.
Thank you.
Is that it?
That's it.
Well,
adios.
Yeah. Goodbye. Thanks.
See ya.